I'm Alan Lytle for 91.3 WUKY. We're debuting a new podcast today called Lexington Stories, Lore, and More with author Fiona Young Brown, where we uncover those stories and lore behind some of our most fascinating spots and quirky spaces. Fiona is the author of Secret Lexington, a guide to the weird, wonderful, and obscure, and that's available through Reedy Press. Welcome in, Fiona.
Hello again, Alan.
And I thought what we would start, since we're so close to Halloween, some of the eerie and creepy stuff about Lexington.
That's always a great place to start, and especially now the leaves, well, they sort of are thinking about turning, but the weather's getting colder, and downtown Lexington, with its history, there are some kind of creepy places, but I don't think too scary. I think kind of creepy in a eerie and historical way.
Yes, and let's start on the Transylvania University campus. That might be one of the creepiest and hottest spots that most people know about.
Yeah, Transy in itself has such a great history because, you know, it was built very, very early on in Lexington's history. And Morrison in particular is this old building. And so I love all the pumpkins on display on the steps of Morrison. I haven't been along there yet to see them. But there's just such a fascinating history about just even that one building overlooking Gratz Park. Does it have ghosts? Who are the ghosts? Students still desperate to spend Halloween night under the stairs in case they see anything. I think it's a wonderful college story as well.
All right, so tell us the story about that.
Okay, so the story is that, well, it goes back to one of the former professors, a very famous, and I find him absolutely fascinating, Raffinesque. And to me, Constantine Raffinesque is just one of these figures that I don't even think you could imagine if he weren't real. You couldn't create him in a book without people saying that's ridiculous, he's too over the top. And he was this Frenchman, and he taught himself, basically. He was very much self-taught in languages, botany, biology, just all of these different subjects. And he then started traveling. He traveled the world collecting specimens of plants and so on, and became kind of this self-taught genius in the field of botany. He had one of the most impressive collections, apparently, and he moved to Lexington in 1819. And at that point, Transy was still one of the few renowned colleges, definitely in this part of the country. You know, if you went back east, there were definitely some prestigious colleges, but Transy was the one here. And so he went there to teach and actually started out teaching French and Italian. You know, we might think he was teaching botany, but no, he was there to teach languages. But for him, that was kind of a means to an end because it also meant that he could come to America. He could travel around and carry on collecting his specimens. And he was a bit of a character. And it's hard to know looking back, you know, how much of this was just he was European, he was different, he was an outsider, he had different mannerisms and so on. But there were a lot of rumors around town. And remember, at this time, Lexington was a much smaller place, so it didn't take long for rumors to start spreading. And there were a lot of rumors that he was spending perhaps a little too much time and getting just a little too cozy with the university president's wife.
Oh, I can see where this is going, and it's not a good place.
Exactly. And you can imagine all of the tongues wagging around Gratz Park and that area, and, you know, people wondering what was going on. And again, it's one of those things of we'll never really know, was something happening, something illicit, or was it just that she was here in Kentucky in this little town and was really keen to chat to someone from outside to chat about his ideas. Either way, the rumors got started. And so he was fired after about 7 years at Transy, he was told, pack your bags, leave town, there's no place for you here. And it's said that as he left, as he walked out of the president's office, he uttered a curse on the future of Transylvania University and everyone there. Which I think, since Transy is still flourishing and doing very well, it's probably fair to say that the curse didn't have much lasting.
Or it's a long time to kick in.
Maybe that's it. He's playing the long game. But at the same time, within a few years of him giving that curse, some things did start to happen. Morrison Hall burned down. The president of the university died of yellow fever. And so, you know, all of these things, there was something to that curse. Oh my God, what did he do? He's cursed the town and so on. And even though those kind of rumors spread, it was actually not until they say, oh, and because of those, they decided to reinter his remains. Actually, it wasn't until 1924, so a good 100 years later, that they decided that they should do right by Raffinesque. They should bring him back to the campus. They should bury him there. And so the rumor is that his tomb is under the steps of Morrison Hall. I don't know if they still do this, although it sounds like a wonderful student ritual if they do, that apparently every year there is a raffle for Transy students and some kind of a competition, and those who win get to spend the night next to the tomb under Morrison Hall to see if they can encounter any ghosts. But here's the thing, it's not actually him in that they brought back the wrong remains.
We know this for a fact.
We do now. And one of the strange things, or I guess not strange, just practical in terms of space, you know, as cities grow, you need more burial space and you need more. And so what are you going to do? You're actually going to eventually end up putting graves on top of other graves, bury people on top of other people and so on. And especially, he was buried in Philadelphia. He actually died in Philadelphia in pretty much poverty and obscurity. After leaving Transy, very few people wanted anything to do with him. But so he was buried in Philadelphia, but overcrowding. This was a big and growing city, and so they would put other bodies on top of, especially once they could tell that, you know, this was a grave that wasn't being cared for, no one was bothered about. And so actually, a few decades after he died, there's a woman called Mary Passamore. She was buried in the same grave on top of Raffinesque. And so they've now actually, yeah, they've done, looked at the records and so on and figured out that it's actually her remains that were brought back to Transy and buried there.
Did she ever curse the university?
Not that we know of. We're not even sure if she would have known about the university, but as far as we know, there was no curse. So he's probably still up, you know, in Philadelphia somewhere. Mary Passamore, who probably had more than likely, I'd say 99% likely, had no connection with Lexington, but is now here forevermore. But at the same time, people say nothing bad has happened to Transy since. It is flourishing. And so who knows? Maybe he was pleased enough. He was like, that'll do. Yeah, they tried to make amends.
I think in the late 1950s, we did have an unsolved murder on the campus. So if you want to tie that to the curse, I think you could do that.
There was. I can't remember her name now. Betty Jean. I wrote about it in another book years ago. But yep, there was an unsolved murder.
So if you draw that line long enough and something bad happens.
If anything bad happens over a 100-year, 200-year period, we can still come back and say it's the curse.
All right. So let's move on to a graveyard that apparently has quite a reputation. I really, until I read your book, I didn't even know about this.
Well, I'd heard about this. Various friends and people around town had said to me, oh, the Witch's Cemetery, which always sounds, you know, I think every town has to have, you know, a headless horseman, a witch's cemetery, and certain other, the Grey Lady or a Lady in White or something. And so people kept telling me about this witch's cemetery on Nicholasville Road, which sounded very sinister and so on. And so that was one of the, actually one of the earliest things that when I started doing the book, I wanted to look into. Because I'd never seen the cemetery. I'd only heard about it from certain friends in certain little circles.
But and this is on Nicholasville Road?
On Nicholasville Road. Okay. And it's once I realized where it was, I realized just how many people drive past it every day and have no idea it's there, which honestly I'm kind of pleased about. It truly is secret to a lot of people. But also the story behind it is actually, it's a fascinating story about Lexington's history, but also it's kind of sad because now it's, I think over the years, it got this reputation, probably because it was just this little burial ground that no one knew about. But the sad part about that is that it's now really suffered a lot of damage from trespassing and no doubt from teenagers and kids over the years saying, hey, this is the witch's cemetery. This is where we'll go hang out.
And I'll bet you $10 that you can't stay the night there without getting freaked out or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. One of those kind of bets. And so now there's very little left of it. A lot of the stones have been damaged and so on. And it's nothing to do with witches. It was actually one of the first or an early settler in Lexington. It was a little family plot. There were dozens of them everywhere. And so, yeah, it's, we don't even know at this point how many graves are there. There are really no accurate records. And with all the damage done, we know that there are at least 13, possibly.
That's an unlucky number.
Although it's now part of the Baptist hospital complex. They say they've identified at least 10 that they can put names to and so on. So some around a dozen, let's say. It's about a dozen. And that whole area, 2,000 acres of what is now Nicholasville Road, Southland, and that whole kind of pile of shops and apartments and so on, was once a 2,000-acre farm and property owned by a John Campbell. Nothing to do with Hull McGowan, which is, by the way, the name of the cemetery. And apparently he was one of the founders of Louisville. There you go. I don't know much about Louisville history, but there you go. There's a connection. But he was left the property. And then he left it to his sister, and his sister married into the family by the name of McGowan. And so the Hull and McGowan families kind of intermarried, and they were buried at this little family plot. There's some children there, you know, obviously infants born and died very early in life. And honestly, at this point, the headstones, they've all been broken down. They've been too wrecked by time, wind, rain, and so on that you can't actually read anything on them anymore. And obviously the damage as well, which is a shame. The nice thing is now that since Baptist Health took it over, they have put a really nice wooden fence, not wooden fence, that wouldn't do anything, an iron fence, a tall iron fence around the entire little plot, so it is locked and
to discourage
trespassers. Exactly, to keep people out. So you can kind of look through the railings and look over, and it's just a very peaceful little plot with some trees and the remains of some headstones, but absolutely nothing witchy, spooky, evil, or anything like that.
How did it even get that reputation? Just the fact that it's a graveyard?
Apparently, from what I tried looking around online, and it seemed to be that the people who did know about it said they heard about it in the 1990s. So that seems to be when this kind of rumor grew up. But other than that, people really, there really isn't much out there. It just seems to be one of these kind of local legends, rumors that probably, as you said, did grow up around teens and, hey, ooh, where are we going to spend the night? I bet you can't go in there after dark. And so, but why that one? Who knows?
All right, let's talk about one ghost that has, well, several actually, ghosts in the downtown Lexington area. Mm-hmm. And maybe the first place we'll start is the Vogt Firehouse.
Which isn't that a beautiful firehouse? It's just a stunning little building. And every time I go past it, I always feel as if it's not big enough to be a firehouse.
No, how do they even get a truck in there?
It is actually, I went to look around. The guys there were great. They let me come and look around the station. And it is tiny.
It's on 3rd Street, correct?
Is it 3rd or Jefferson? It's actually on Jefferson Street. It's okay. Just around off of 3rd Street.
Around 3rd and Jefferson.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yes. And yeah.
So it is a tiny, tiny fire station. They were very generous and let me come and look. In terms of you asking how they can get a fire truck in there.
Very carefully.
Yes.
I think would be the answer.
With much more parking skill than I would dare to even attempt on a vehicle that size. They literally have to pull in, he told me, and then at the last minute you kind of have to swerve to a certain angle just so that you can actually get it in there and the doors can shut. There is only room for the one. And then they have, I think it was 3 or 4 staff at that station. There really isn't room for any more. When I visited, I was amazed because they have their workout gear, you know, the treadmill and stuff, kind of wedged in around where the fire truck parks. So this is not a large, spacious, you know, place to go. They have to take it in turns if they want to use the gym equipment, and they really spend most of their time upstairs when they're not at fires. There's beautiful original wrought iron curved staircase as you go inside. But yeah, it's tiny. They actually can't really expand on it because of where it is. But the land was given to the city. And the agreement when it was given to the city was that there must be a firehouse on that.
Forever.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is why you now have this very tiny, but actually really kind of charming firehouse. But yeah, if you are dreaming of being a firefighter and want to work there, please learn how to park that fire truck, because one piece of damage to that building.
Maybe it all comes down.
Exactly. And it would have to be rebuilt. It was actually named for a member of the city's fire committee, Henry Vogt. And when he gave the land and so on, he basically said, he lived nearby. And so he wanted to make sure that, you know, his neighborhood was well protected, even if the others weren't at that point in time. And so that's why there's the fire station and there has to be.
Is Vogt the ghost that haunts this place?
He's not. You kind of think that since he was so keen about protecting his neighborhood and making sure that things went on there, you might think he would stick around. But actually, it's not. The ghost dates back to the end of, well, just after World War II, and was a firefighter at the station, Henry McDonald. And apparently he worked there for most of his career, and he was just known as being thoroughly, thoroughly dedicated. He loved being a firefighter. And he was still working there when he was 69. Which it's
talk about dedicated to your craft.
Exactly. It's kind of hard to imagine now. I don't think we have any 69-year-old firefighters in town. I don't know. If we do, congratulations.
Hats off to you. Or helmets off to
exactly.
you, actually.
And so Christmas Day, 1945, he was working. And apparently that night he climbed into his bunk at the station and just drifted off to sleep and never woke up again. He's buried in Winchester. So he was from Clark County. And so he's buried out there. But a lot of people still think that his spirit is still at the station, that he's still dedicated to his job and to the Real House. People have said that they've heard boots, you know, boots stepping up that iron staircase. And that is one of those kind of old-fashioned ones. So,
and they would make a lot of noise.
Exactly. And they said they've heard that. They've heard cold air, that his old rocking chair, which apparently, according to some, is still upstairs. And they've said that suddenly that may start creaking backwards and forwards. And so they've kind of, you know, adopted the idea that, yep, maybe Henry's still around. The odd thing is, when I went to look around, I did actually ask. I was like, so have you seen anything? And the captain of the station at the time said, you know, I really haven't. He, you know, he's been there for quite a few years and said that he hasn't noticed anything, but other firefighters there have said, you know, did you feel that or whatever? And so either way, now it's sort of, oh, that must have been Henry who did that and so on. And that's why they got their name. All of the fire stations in Lexington have, you know, a name and a mascot and so on. And theirs is the Phantoms.
The Phantoms?
Yeah.
Really?
And they actually show me they have, over the years, it's kind of taken on a different logo for the Phantom, but it's on their trucks for Fire Station 4. At the moment, it's kind of a scary-looking skeleton with a firefighter's helmet and flames behind him and so on. But, yeah, their nickname is the Phantoms in memory of the legend of Henry MacDonald and whether or not he's still around.
That could be Henry himself after some rough times in the grave. But that is a fascinating story. And I know that when people take ghost walks through town around this time of year, that they do tell that tale.
Yep. They said that usually around Halloween time, they kind of open it up a little bit for trick-or-treating or a few little ghost walks so that,
it's a good story. Okay, so there's other ghosts, especially around the Gratz Park area.
Gratz Park area is great. And actually, that's where I've taken a few ghost walks around there before. You know,
you hear all
the stories about, well, okay, this house and the little turrets on the top and the staircases and things. And I think a lot of this, whether there are ghosts there or not, the history of the area definitely lends itself to that. And the architecture, you know, when you've got these big sweeping staircases, it's great for a dramatic story about someone who throws themselves down or has this terrible accident and so on.
Okay, so there's one, especially in the Bodley Bullock House, correct?
Yes.
Supposedly.
Supposedly.
Yes.
And again, that's one, with its history during the Civil War and so on, you'd really expect it to be maybe a Civil War era ghost, something military, you know, some soldiers and so on. And it's not. It was actually the most recent resident. She's called Miss Minnie. And the house, Bodley Bullock House, is now taken care of by the Lexington Women's Junior League. I hope I've said that right.
Yes, the Junior League of Lexington. Yes, they put on the charity horse show.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so they take care of the house now, and they always affectionately call her Miss Minnie. She was the wife of a doctor that lived in the house for about 40 years, I believe, and she helped to set up the Ladies Gardening League in Lexington. She was a devoted gardener, loved all of that, and was quite, you know, a respected woman among the women's associations and organizations around town. She didn't have children, apparently disliked children. They were noisy, messy, and so on. And that actually kind of plays into the ghost stories. And the other thing to know about her is that her husband, who was a local doctor, was a little bit of a drinker, and she was a strict teetotaler.
Oh, yeah, you could see this as a marriage made in heaven.
And so apparently, you know, she would have a lot of rules of no smoking and no drinking inside the house, and so he would kind of, you know, step outside for for that. But yeah, he enjoyed a
for his tonic
a dram of brandy and so on, or bourbon for healing purposes, I'm sure.
Certainly, yes, medicinal.
And so after her husband died, she stayed in the house for a long time. And because they didn't have any children, there was the question of, you know, what happens to the house afterwards. And it eventually went to Transy, Transylvania University, I believe, still technically owns it. And they lease it to the Junior League, who take care of it, maintain it, and so on. But a couple of the stipulations were that no alcohol could ever be drunk in the house. And children...
Frowned upon.
Please don't, if possible, and so on. Which is all very well. You know, the house has been very nicely maintained. But I suppose it must be about 15 years ago now, the Junior League started thinking about having weddings. Actually, it was probably longer ago than that. But thought, this is a great wedding venue.
And I attended one way back in the 90s.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah. Longer ago than that.
Yeah.
And so when they were thinking about this, they were trying to think, you know, this would be a great wedding venue. We've got the gardens. We've got this beautiful historic house. It's hard to have a wedding sometimes without a little bit of alcohol.
Some libation.
A toast or two. And so they apparently decided, you know, we need to discuss this in our board meeting. Weddings are obviously a way of bringing in income to maintain the house. And it is said that when they took the vote and they voted to allow alcohol for weddings, it is said that they have this beautiful big board table that they all meet around, this huge old wooden table with a glass top to protect it. And it's said that after they took the vote and approved alcohol, that the glass on top of the table cracked from one end to another.
Miss Minnie had a conniption.
And they all kind of looked at one another and said, Miss Minnie's not going to be happy about this.
She just showed us why.
There have been other stories related to it since then. They've said that sometimes at weddings, you know, they'll come into the little kitchen area and the glasses have all been moved or put away. And then in terms of, remember I said she didn't like children, apparently at a couple of weddings, sometimes, you know, if the kids get a little tired, you might put them in a bedroom upstairs, tell them to just lay down, take a nap and so on.
Time out.
And a little boy came down in one wedding and said, well, I can't. And, you know, his parents were like, well, you're supposed to be up there. Go on, go back. He said, I can't. The mean old lady told me I couldn't stay up there.
Wow.
And they said, well, no, there isn't. Don't be silly. And, yep, he just kept insisting. And apparently several children have had this thing of, you know, when they lay down on the bed, in what was her room as well. This was her bedroom that apparently... rather unfriendly to them, old lady comes out and says, you're not supposed to be in here. You need to go.
Get out of my bed.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
But other than that, I mean, if she is there, the Junior League have said she's just kind of a friendly presence. You know, she loves the house and is just keeping an eye on things and making sure that they're the way she would have them.
But that decision to allow alcohol that sealed the fate there.
It did. I do like that story of the tabletop just cracking right down the middle. I mean,
so children have a bad encounter with Miss Minnie. Has any grown up or an adult? Is there a story out there about an encounter with Miss Minnie?
You know, I'm trying to think of any, and I don't think there have been any sort of hostile ones. And I can't think of anything that was too direct. It's mainly kind of a sense, knowing that there's someone there. A few little things might occasionally be put back into place if they're left out. So I think that's why, as I said, they tend to refer to her just as Miss Minnie. You know, she's just, they don't see her as unfriendly or making the place uncomfortable or anything. She just wants to welcome the right people. not children.
And there are other ghosts, I guess, in the Gratz Park area. Tell us another story about maybe in the house across the street, perhaps. The Hunt Morgan?
Now, the Hunt Morgan house, I'm trying to think of any ghost stories. I know there are. I've been to ghost talks there. You would think I could remember those right now. I don't remember that. But the house, I want to say next to the Hunt Morgan house, which I don't remember the name of, but I do remember when the times that I've taken ghost tours, they've always pointed out that one, and there's kind of a little turreted room at the top.
And there was a silhouette.
Yes.
I do remember that, but I don't remember who.
I know, that's it.
The silhouette.
I clearly need to go on another one this year, but yeah, I remember it seems as if every other window we'd be stopping up and looking eagerly to see if we could find silhouettes looking down or watching to see what we were doing.
The Mary Todd Lincoln House, do they purport to have a ghost there?
You know, that would make sense, but I've never actually heard of anything there. Although definitely, I would say given its history over the years, you know, it's been used for so many things, not just as a historical house for Mary Todd Lincoln's family. So it seems as though there should be some kind of activity in there. The same with Ashland. You would expect there to be something. But I'm actually friends with the curator, and he tells me that there isn't. I know there are ghost groups that all desperately try to get in there to look. The Kentucky Theater, obvious. I mean, theaters always have that kind of spooky feel.
People who have clearly overstayed their welcome.
Yes.
Perhaps would be one way of putting it.
So I'm sure the Kentucky Theater probably has some kind of stories. There was a ghost hunt, kind of an overnight thing at the Carnegie Center, from what I remember last year. And I seem to, a lot of friends that participated all said, you know, there were definitely eerie goings on in the Carnegie Center. But again, it's that, you know, it's Gratz Park, it's the historical, it's that beautiful staircase. All of those things, I think, lend themselves to thinking that something might be happening, whether it is or not. I'm not saying one way or the other.
No, we are just, you know, reporting what's already out there.
Exactly.
And apparently there's a lot out there, as this conversation has attempted to prove. Before we wrap it up, anything to sort of add to Lexington's eerie ghost lore?
You know, this one occurred to me as I was coming over today. I haven't heard anything, but I would be fascinated to go out to the old mounds just outside of the Adena Mounds and so on.
Oh, the first residents of
Lexington. Where the first residents of Lexington. You know, that area, nobody lives out there now. It's closed off by the university and so on. But I kind of feel as if that would be a truly eerie place to be at night. You know, imagining that what was happening there 10,000 years ago and so on with the very first people. That, to me, would be an eerie, a truly spooky kind of place.
I would think also going out to maybe Harrodsburg and staying overnight in the fort.
Yes.
There.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably hear the cries and the wind blowing and just get a, wow, just an overall eerie, chilly feeling.
Exactly,
there.
Yep. So. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, Fiona, for sitting in today. Again, the name of the book is A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure, Secret Lexington. The name of this podcast is Lexington Stories, Lore, and More. Tell your friends. And the next time that we get together, Fiona, we're going to talk about some of the buildings, the architectural gems and oddities of Lexington. And we want to thank you again for your time today.
Thank you, Alan.
And we'll see you next time on Lexington Stories, Lore, and More from 91.3 WUKY.